Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is February 19th, 2023. And this is episode 368. I'm the co-host Mark Ames. I'm here in Rochester, New York. The reason I laugh is because I'm like, it should be the easiest thing to remember which number it is. And I'd say about half the times I'm off by one or two. And I have to get reminded by Brendan, this is not 368. Anyway, I'm the ghost Mark Ames. Yeah, and you're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm on with the Warnerd, line with the Warnerd, Gary Brecher, a.k.a. John Dolan, outside of Glasgow and Scotland. How you doing, John?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah, we're in Clydebank on the outskirts of Glasgow, and we did a walk today along one of the many canals. I mean, like your place, this is a canal landscape. And
those old Scots love their canals, huh?
They do. And apparently it's a big thing for the local adolescents to see how many shopping trolleys they can push into the canal. And the local paper said that they did 50 on Friday night. And the weird thing is there are these beautiful ducks, like ringneck ducks, common mergansers, swans, and they're swimming around, you know, with the half-sunken shopping carts, and I don't know, they don't seem to mind.
Yeah, nature's pretty adaptable in that grim way. But that's good. At least they're not dropping dead from that, at least not from that.
No, I mean, it's mostly metal, good old metal. It's better than what that train is pumping out into Ohio, I suppose.
Did you follow it all? So people who sort of follow Scotland seem to take this news as pretty big deal, the resignation of the leader of the SNP the other day. But do you know that? I don't know if you know any of the details about it. I don't. I gather that it turned out she was kind of one of these sort of not really enthusiastic about being a nationalist, or that's what I think people are more independence inclined think. And so they didn't seem to really, but I don't know. Or that she's caught up in some kind of scandal.
I know that the right people hate her guts. I mean, really hate her guts. And she seemed like a good person as far as I could tell. But she was trying to keep a party together in a way that involved getting whipsawed by the overwhelmingly English and right-wing English press, the tabloid press. The Daily Mail ran a nonstop hate campaign on her for years and years. And they managed to draw the party into a lot of very fraught fights about social issues that didn't really have anything to do with independence. And they, even though papers like the Daily Mail mock those issues all the time, they were useful as something to whipsaw her with. And I think it just wore her out eventually. But I have a very good impression of her.
Yeah, I mean, the English are good at that. I mean, the anti-Semitism slur against Corbyn and Corbyn followers, which is just the most counterintuitive thing imaginable.
Unless you think not even going to be allowed to run as a Labour candidate.
Yeah, it's amazing. It just keeps going, and there are people. I mean, certainly the establishment media, all of the media except on the really left, they all just agree. Yeah, that happened. That's a real thing. Yep. Even though it's been exposed 10 different ways as bullshit. It's amazing. And that thing still has juice in it. It's weird. That's scary. It seemed they were kind of trying to do that to Bernie. Ultimately, they didn't need to because he didn't get control of the party. And I personally don't think he really ultimately wanted it. He thought Biden, his buddy Biden, would do a good job. And that's that.
Yeah. But, well, I mean, I naively thought Bernie would be immune to the anti-Semitism charge because, you know, he's a Jew. And he's not only a Jew, but he's a lot more Jewish, it seems, than any of the other Jews who were talking about him. But that didn't make any difference.
They tried. I'm just saying it didn't stick, though.
Yeah.
But they
yeah.
definitely tried and threw it shamelessly, threw that out yeah. there. It was, if you believe that the Likud party and Meir Kahan are Jewish, are what is Jewish, the only Jewish, then yeah, I guess any opposition to the extreme fascist right is anti-Jewishness, you know.
Yeah.
That's the only like logic I can see about that. If you believe apartheid is Jewish and a good thing, then yeah, if you're against apartheid in Israel, you are anti-Semitic, I guess. So we're going to try and take a stab at a very large, difficult subject, which is Carthage, since mm-hmm. John was there and we talked about it. And at first we were sort of like, well, maybe we should do Carthage, capital C, and the Punic Wars. And the more we kind of got into them, the more we realized that there's just too much to do there, I think, and probably too many people who know. I mean, maybe someday we'll get like one of our great either amateur or real historians or something to work mm-hmm. with us on it. But there's just so much there. And what mm-hmm. we wanted to talk about was something kind of somewhat more specific, Salambo yeah. and the Mercenary War, which means understanding Carthage and means understanding the First Punic War. So yeah. that's what we're going to talk about. But before
and,
we do,
and we also yeah. want to talk, I mean, I think one of the things we can do usefully is talk about how you make sense of a narrative that has already been set
right.
into orthodoxy, but when you look at it, doesn't quite make sense. So we're not going to try to lay down the law about
right.
what really happened, but we would like to stir the ashes a little and see what's going on in there.
Yeah. Before we get to that, I don't know, a couple things we can talk about real quickly. One is your great newsletter for subscribers that just came out on jihad, on Western jihadists, I guess, and Dune and Frank Herbert. I mean, it's a great, it's like if folks have been reading Warner columns and newsletters going back, you know, some years, like this is really just a classic example of the newsletter.
Nice.
I loved it. Yeah, it's great. And, you know, as what was it, Michael Pollack said, you know, what is it with Northern California's SFF and houseboats, John, or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, because Frank Herbert and Jack Vance famously co-owned a houseboat and lived there with their families in the Delta, the Sacramento River Delta, in the summers. Yeah, although, you know, Catherine and I didn't have a houseboat. We had an actual boat. It didn't go anywhere because I never quite figured out how to get a diesel engine started from scratch. But, you know, it was an actual boat. But anyway, yeah, I think the lesson there is if you are going to have a houseboat, have it in California in the summer, not in British Columbia in the winter. That would be a yeah. good start. But yeah, I wanted to do something about jihad, because there's been a lot of articles excitedly saying, look at Frank Herbert. He anticipated Islamic State, and that isn't quite the case. And I think by the benefit of being an old sci-fi fan from way back then, I can reconstruct a little about how remote the idea of jihad seems and how that remoteness had a part in the appeal the concept had for Herbert.
I mean, I just would imagine most SFF, both especially writers actually, and fans, they also are fans of older kingdoms and wars, and you'd yeah. want to get, especially if you're getting into creative writing, you'd look for some epics that your own culture is not entirely familiar with, that might have a little bit of familiarity with, but not entirely. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Especially because the nomenclature is so important. I mean, like mm-hmm. in this newsletter, I said, okay, try coming up with invent a planet and come up with a name for that planet.
Yeah.
And you will be mortally embarrassed by how lame the invented names are. This was a feature of the first yes. version of Star Trek. Oh, the planet Glorf.
yeah, I guess Philip Dick kind of got around that by making everything kind of grimly funny in a way, or yeah. sort of like almost blandly funny or something.
Yeah, he was like using advertising language.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And weird slang from the business world of his times and just dropping it on imagined planets. You got to do something. And Herbert in Dune used Arabic and Turkish terms, but that led a lot of people, like including this one writer for Al Jazeera, who was understandably excited about this. But you got to say, that doesn't mean he really looked into the whole question of Islamic legalism and mm-hmm. the concept of jihad. These guys are magpies. They just grab bright, shiny objects. They were right. writing pulp novels on what had to be a quick deadline because they didn't get any money for these things.
Yeah, they had to write a lot of them with a lot of pages yeah. and put out several of them to get some kind of a steady income going.
And the funny thing is they still had glorious lives. You know, they had wonderful lives that were completely broke, which you could kind of do in those days.
Yeah, and you could fail and still have second and third chances. On you
know, many chances.
Many, many, many. By the way, just got an email from previous Radio Warner guest, Terry Marignac, saying how much he loved it. I forwarded it to you.
Oh, good.
He asked if he could actually translate into French and post it. And he said the whole text is brilliant, smart, extremely well written. And he said, could you let him know how impressed I am? And and then he reminded me, and I didn't know this about him. He said, I interviewed Jack Vance once.
Good God.
I know. And I said, wait a minute, you interviewed God?
yeah.
Like, how did we not know this? So I got to find out more about that.
Hell yes. Please yeah. do.
I mean, wow. I know Thierry's been publishing novels and getting written up in the big, you know, made like Le Figaro and the big major papers there. And he's kind of doing semi sci-fi novels, kind of semi druggy sci-fi novels that have gotten, it's gotten a lot bigger lately, which is cool.
Wow.
And I know Scanner Darkly, I think for his generation, that was, it was never my favorite. I like Scanner Darkly, but I have to say, maybe because I already knew Dick before I read it, and I had heard so much about it. So when I finally got to it, it was a bit of a letdown.
Yeah,
I went and read it again. I was like, okay, yeah, this is good. But like, I still don't, it's not the one that blew me away. Which is
no,
like,
there's one great thing in it. It has, to me, the best version of what a particular kind of evil person that I think we both knew from the Berkeley world, the kind of horrible brat who hit his peak in the SAT and never amounted to much after that and spends the rest of his life thinking of himself as a great intriguer and ruining as many lives around him as he can.
Yeah. Yeah. Those people were legion at Berkeley, actually.
Yes. There's one in Scanner Darkly. Unfortunately, when they tried to make a kind of animation movie out of it, I think Philip Seymour Hoffman played him, and he played it fine, but the director didn't understand the character. He made him kind of cute or something, and he is not cute.
Yeah, the director did not understand the book or the character. It's just somebody who thinks paranoia is interesting but has no concept of it at all. Real briefly also before we move on, well, I actually posted something on this in the Radio Warner page, but I got these notifications through the two-step authenticator or whatever. First, it was like Tuesday or Wednesday, I got a notification that basically somebody had hacked, it seems, into my Gmail account. If I were to have responded to the authentication, it would have confirmed and let them in. And then a day or two later, I got the same thing through my Facebook account. And, you know, it seems obvious.
You don't have to be a wild-eyed conspiracy theorist to connect the dot reading Seymour Hersh interview with that.
Yeah, I guess there'd probably be trying to find something incriminating on Hirsch even. Although they don't like me either based on replies I get and my replies on Twitter. Yeah. But I just assume, you know, there's so many people, freelancers, volunteers, people. I mean, this is one of the things that social media really brought out. It turns out that snitching, it's not hard to find snitches. There are people lining up around the block for miles, begging, dying to be a snitch, dying to turn somebody in on one side or the other. It's just pretty awful. I don't know if every culture is that bad, but certainly this culture is. And
I've been wondering about that because, I mean, I like true crime novels. And purely coincidentally, I came across two true crime novels, which both involve somebody telling someone else, I'm with the CIA, will you help me kill someone? And both times they say, sure, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So hopefully, I don't know, man, I don't know stuff about OPSEC and that stuff. I'm getting some advice on what to do now. Apparently, it's very easy to get better OPSEC. So apparently, I'll hopefully have that figured out. God knows what a drag it would be to have people, I don't know, scan through your emails. And I don't have anything incriminating, I don't think, but certainly embarrassing. I'm sure there's something there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you don't have something embarrassing, you're not human.
Yeah. A lot of people aren't human, I think.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
But what else? So, you know, before we go on, I don't know. I'm not sure if we need to really say much about the latest in the Ukraine-Russia war. I mean, we did the Seymour Hersh interview this month, and that covered a lot of it. Only I would say there's sort of a kind of a rolling debate going on about is Russia actually already in its big offensive? Did it start? Is it happening? Or is it yet to start? And this is all preparation. Whatever has started is not going very well, at least in Vuhledar. Even the Russian nationalists are furious about basically another one of these situations where they just led their soldiers into a pretty easy kill zone, armor and soldiers. You know, they're making incremental gains in some other areas. But the big thing that happened was, I think Ben mentioned this when we talked to him, was that Putin replaced Surovikin, who he brought in at the sort of nadir of the Russian war in Ukraine. In the very beginning of October, I guess, of last year, after everything was falling. And Surovikin is clearly much more of a defensive mind, which is smart, quite frankly.
Yeah.
I mean, ideally, they would just end the war, but, you know, they're not doing that. But if we talk about just what would be smart, the smart thing would be to get defensive for quite a while because they don't have much offensive juice. It's pretty clear. And Surovikin stayed in long enough to basically shore things up and get all these mobilized conscripts just trained up enough where their bodies can be used. They would make better defensive soldiers than offensive soldiers, though, as you've pointed out many times. But it looks like they're being inserted to fill up gaps constantly. And Surovikin was replaced, I don't know, a few weeks ago, a month or so ago, by the infamous General Gerasimov, who has been probably responsible for all the other failures in the war before Surovikin took over. He's back in and things aren't going that great. Again, I don't want to predict what it means. You can just say that things aren't going so great now unless you think moving a couple city blocks in one area and getting mauled in another area is great. One thing about reading about like how long the first Punic War went on, it's just over and over. It's not just that war, but many of them. They go into these wars just so sure that it's unimaginable that this thing can go on more than beyond my plan, you know, which is like a month to 3 months out, you know, maybe in that era, a year out. But it's just, and then once they're in, what do they call it? The sunk cost theory or something. Like there's just no way to get out because they've already invested so much.
Yeah. Politically, I mean, it's impossible. It's sad to remember that Lincoln brought McClellan back. That was how little talent it seemed that there was in the Union command. He knew McClellan amounted to nothing, but then he tried Burnside, and everybody knew Burnside was going to be a disaster, and indeed, Burnside was a disaster in very much the offensive way, leading the troops straight up a hill against Lee's veterans behind a stone wall at Mary's Heights in Fredericksburg. And then he had to bring McClellan back. And that really delighted the South. That showed the North that we are doomed here. We've got nobody. So, yeah, it's not an encouraging move if you're trying to support the Russian army. So no wonder those nationalists are upset by it.
Yeah. They try to put a brave face on, and you know, even Hirsch said, look, the war is going badly for Ukraine, much worse for Ukraine than our press lets on, which I have no doubt that's true. I mean, that's a state secret that the U.S. press is, cooperating with completely, which is Ukrainian losses. No doubt they're brutal and awful. But that doesn't mean things are going great. Therefore, things are going great for the other side. I mean,
yeah.
A lot of wars, things go really awful for both sides. And then ultimately, it's sort of, it's kind of a weird test of wills as well as logistics, you know, later on. But the war has a lot of juice, but neither side seems to have much offensive juice. It's the best I could say right now. Right. I think we should get to the sort of background to Salambo and the Mercenary War.
Yeah. Also known as the Truceless War.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an era of great kindness. So when they distinguish a particular war as truceless, they mean yikes.
Yeah, that's true. All right. So let's go on. Let's talk about the Truceless War in Carthage.
Let's talk Carthaginians. Yes. Who are the Carthaginians? They are a Semitic people, or they were, and it's a Semitic language.
Very close to ancient Hebrew, by the way. As I understand it, it would be like Russian and Ukrainian or something. I mean, they'd be able to understand each other. It was that close.
Yeah, and very, they have a written alphabet that is maybe 1,000 years older than the Latin one. They were originally from Phoenicia. They survived the Bronze Age collapse in about 1200 BC because they tended to build their cities on highly defensible islands like Tyre in what's now Lebanon. Alexander the Great got so mad at Tyre because he had to build a causeway to it to take it that he massacred a good number of the inhabitants. And he wasn't really that kind of a guy. He just, he was mad. So they had very defensible cities. They did a lot of colonizing. A lot of different groups were colonizing the Mediterranean at the time. There were Greek colonies, there were Phoenician colonies. And one of the colonies of Tyre was Carthage, which comes from Carthadasht or something like that. The vowels are lost because it was a Semitic alphabet.
Right.
Something like that.
Always incredibly annoying if you ever had to go to Hebrew school.
Yeah.
They invented, I assume much later, these fake vowels for dummies like us so you could read it. And then you had to look at the real thing and you're like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, I found that with Arabic, too, in my unsuccessful siege of the Arabic language. It was like you absolutely had to guess what the vowels were going to be. And they did occasionally write them if they thought something was going to be read by foreigners. But that was training wheel stuff.
Can I just say a little something about their colonizing? One of the big impetuses for really colonizing way out to the Western Mediterranean, as I understand it, was the Assyrian Empire. I was reading one book about ancient Carthage, and the Assyrians make an appearance, I think around the 9th, 10th, 9th century BC. And I got to say, they come off, they're really scary. I don't know much about the Assyrian Empire except like through a few Bible stories or something. But in reality, they do come off quite frightening, but practical, but just really pay us the fucking money, you know, or you die. And they usually just sort of destroyed everyone. They didn't destroy Tyre or a lot of the Phoenician ones because they thought, well, we'll get more money basically shaking them down. And then not like directly controlling them, but making sure. And so, and what the Assyrians wanted, because they built like the most giant, massive palace maybe in the history of all empires. And they needed to feed just enormous amounts of silver and other metals towards it. And where there was a lot of silver, it turned out, and Phoenicians, man, they were just, you know, they were incredible merchants, incredible traders. They were innovators in shipping. They built boats that, you know, you could actually take out into the Mediterranean Sea and wouldn't get destroyed. Anyway, they found in Spain, you know, a mother load of silver, and this is going to continuously be a running theme, but back in the ninth century BC. And, man, they went through Gibraltar and went, you know, outside up the coast, like up the coast of Europe, north and south along the coast of Africa. I mean, they went everywhere. They were incredible.
Yeah, one of the Hannos. One of the problems with talking about Carthage is everybody is either named Hanno or Hannibal or Hamilcar or something.
Hamilcar,
but anyway, one of the early Hannos, Hanno the Great, sailed halfway down the coast of Africa. It's incredible.
Yeah.
So most of these colonies that were founded around the shores of the Mediterranean were small and stayed small, like 1,000 people or less. But a few got very big. And Carthage got very big by the standards of the era. At a peak, maybe Carthage had 400,000 people. Rome was bigger by the time they got into it fully, and that really mattered because Rome could draw on a bigger population. But Carthage had a big population too. It just wasn't, well, we'll talk about this, it wasn't as war-centric as the Roman population was. But it came into Roman literature and into Western literature around the 9th century, when it's founded, because it becomes part of the Trojan story. That raises the question of when we're talking about with the Iliad, and a lot of books have been written on that. But anyway, the angle for the Romans when they were trying to invent their own epic and invent an epic past for themselves was... how are we going to deal with Carthage? They were here first. So they invent the story that Aeneas was the son of Venus, and she protected him at the fall of Troy. He goes west fleeing, and he ends up in Carthage with Dido. Mm-hmm. Dido, as told in the Aeneid, had founded Carthage when a local Berber king agreed to grant her refuge and as much land as she could cover with an oxhide. It's you're supposed to imagine, you know, the Berber king going, you can have as much land as you can cover with an oxhide. But she's one of those clever heroines, so... she proceeds to cut the ox hide into really tiny strips. And, you know, this shows her skill as a household manager, a châtelaine, because she probably cuts it really thin. And she places it around this hill, the Bursa, which really is, you would definitely go for that. That's the real estate. That is like the Berkeley Hills of this whole thing.
I was going to say, they have a great nose for real estate, don't they?
Oh, God,
the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians in particular, yeah.
Better than the hippies even, I swear.
That's saying something, yeah.
Yep. And so she takes this little, like, one molecule wide oxhide strip and winds it all around the hill of the Bursa. You know, like in all these stories, this particular Berber king is a man of his word, unlike your typical local king who would say, the hell with you, lady, I'll just kill you. But anyway, yeah, he keeps his word. Carthage is founded. Aeneas lands in Virgil's story, which was written around 20 BC, around the beginning of the Christian era. And he arrives after the fall of Troy, falls in love with Dido because, of course, and betrays her because, of course. It's a very colonialist narrative. Mm-hmm. Like, you were great, baby. It's not you, but I've got a bigger agenda to deal with. I got to found Rome here. And Dido knows this. She figures it out. She builds a massive pyre and throws herself on it while she says this curse. Right. Let there be no love or treaties between our peoples. Rise, some unknown avenger from my dust, who will pursue the Trojan colonists, that is the Romans, with fire and sword, now or in a time to come, whenever the strength is granted him. I pray that shore be opposed to shore, water to wave, weapon to weapon. Let them fight, them and their descendants. And it's, I mean, I heard these stories as a kid. I didn't read the Aeneid, but, you know, I heard like kiddie versions of them. And there's another story like that, that when Hannibal is a child, his father, Hamilcar, takes him into some sacred cave or someplace. And, you know, he's like seven or something. And he says, swear that you will always be the enemy of Rome and that you will fight them to the death. And I, you know, I kind of like that sort of story for various reasons. Like, you know, he's going to lose. You know, he's going to die. You know, the Romans are going to win. But he keeps his vow.
That one's more believable, though.
Oh, yeah. They were the Barcas. The Barcas were very much the war party in Carthage. And one of the interesting and not very reassuring implications of this story is that sometimes the war party is right. I mean, Rome was not your average trade rival who could be scared off or bought off. Either you were going to kill them or they were going to kill you, which they finally did. Yeah, the peace party in Carthage does not come off very well. It's strange. Anyway, so Carthage booms. Wow. They've got the whole Western Mediterranean. There's nobody really competing with them. There are Greek colonies there, but they can't organize well enough. Rome is focusing on taking the Italian mainland.
I mean, look where Carthage is situated, too. It's like directly south of Sardinia and Corsica, where it had colonies, you know, right near Sicily, right in the middle of the Mediterranean. So it's just perfectly Venice-like situated for what it
does. I mean, it's as far north as the parts of Sicily. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah.
The Med, I imagine, you know, like there's Sicily and then way south somewhere there's Tunisia. No.
Right.
They're level.
Yeah, it's almost level with latitudinally with Syracuse. It's like north of Malta slightly. That's so weird.
There's an Italian island called Lampedusa, which I recognize from Italian news because a lot of refugees land there these days, which is way, way south of Tunis, way south, which is why the refugees land there. Carthage hits its stride at the end of the 7th century BC. It's really going strong. Rome becomes a republic around 500 BC. And originally, there's a treaty because, you know, at this town, the Mediterranean is big enough for both of us at this stage. There's a really strong sense you get of how roomy the world was back then. It must have been glorious in a way. Well, if you didn't have a toothache or an abscess or, you know. But, you know, I mean, there would have been so much room for everybody, which is why, you know, they could grab the best real estate. Why not? So there's an early treaty, but Carthage is soon involved in wars over Sicily. You know, as we know from Thucydides. Mm-hmm. Sicily had some pretty powerful cities there, a little too powerful for Athens, and they were quite capable of taking on Carthage. And being Greek, they were also, I would say, a little more warlike. The Carthaginians, you know, they didn't seem to have the they didn't seem to love it the way the Greco-Roman tradition did.
They were about trade.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and war was something you had to do to keep the business going, but it wasn't like the Romans with war. They don't seem to be obsessed with it in the same way.
No, they definitely weren't. I mean, Philip Mattishek has a really good book, The Enemies of Rome, in which he really stresses that. And he sort of mourns in the beginning of the book all the cultures that Rome flattened to make itself dominant. And Carthage was one of them.
By the way, John, Sicily, I had this idea of Sicily, maybe from The Godfather, that it was kind of dry with sort of, you know, olive trees. But the way it's described at that time, it was like this sort of, it was one of the best bits of agricultural land in that whole region. Is that, was it like that when you're there at all? Or is it drier only recently? Or is it just The Godfather only gets one little part of it?
We were there in winter and it was pretty wet actually and green, sort of like California, you know, it wets up in the winter and greens up and then it dries out, I think. But the whole region was wetter. There was a specific species of elephant, a really sad story, the North African elephant that got used in the wars and used in the circuses and exterminated. And it lived in the forests along the coast, and there were forests along the coast. There still are. We saw them on the way from Hammamet to Tunis, but they're more like chaparral forests, not full-on forests. And there were apparently big forests, plenty of rain for raising crops and for pasture. It was a much friendlier place. Mm-hmm. The Sicilians occupying this paradise, which it probably was, get involved in a series of wars that go from 480 BC all the way down to 339 BC, a series of six Sicilian wars in which Carthage tries to occupy the whole of Sicily. But they never really had that, as you say, obsessive concern for conquest that the Romans had. In fact, the typical Carthaginian navy move seems to have been, this guy's a trade rival. He's not part of our cartel. Ram him, sink the ship. Or just, if there's anything good on there, take it and then ram the ship and send it to the bottom. They were more practical than that. They were, as you say, they were thinking about future trade. They're quite willing to cut throats in favor of future trade, but they didn't enjoy it for its own sake in quite the same way. Then they get involved in a war that we're going to have to talk about at some episode in the future against Pyrrhus, one of the descendants of Alexander, who's kind of a freelance king, kind of a condottiero or something like that, who gets involved in the Sicilian Wars, hoping to carve out a kingdom for himself. And then at that point, Carthage makes a deal with the Romans. They actually ferry the Romans in their ships against Pyrrhus. And Pyrrhus is famous, of course, for Pyrrhic victory because he's up against the Romans, who are quite a thing, quite a new thing. And he says to one of his generals who said, we won. He says, if we win again like this, I'm not going to have an army left because the Romans always made you pay, even if they lost. Just scary people.
Yeah.
So Pyrrhus is defeated in southern Italy by the Romans with Carthaginian help. And the cities of southern Italy, which even now is called Magna Graecia, they're very aware of their Greek past, submit to Rome. And that ends the Pyrrhic War. And it's a good moment to see the sort of lack of strategic vision in the Carthaginian elite. Like, they helped Rome. Was that smart? They thought so because, you know, all right, we have a deal with these people. We'll have a stable trade arrangement. We do the West Mediterranean. They do Italy and Greece and all that. That'll be fine. But they did not understand Rome, clearly. Rome was, I mean, there have been Marxist historians arguing that as Roman agriculture became latifundi, giant estates owned by a single aristocrat, that Rome became sort of like a slave-raiding ant hill. And conquest and slave raids became the basis of the economy. And to placate the displaced working class, you created the army and fed them and offered them a piece of land at the end of their long, long service. But, you know, Rome was not going to compromise. They were never happy with the status quo. They probably would have invented space flight just to take Mars if they'd been around long enough.
Yeah.
So this leads to the first Punic War. There are going to be three.
It reminds me a little bit of America. As soon as America, the Americans, conquered the whole continent, you know, went from the Atlantic all the way to the Pacific, it like they barely even took a breath before they started what is called the, you know, the age of imperialism, right? It's like, okay, now we're going to start conquering overseas. And it's been that ever since. And so you would think the Carthaginians would see, okay, they're gobbling up this peninsula, you know, mountain by mountain, town by town, colony. And once they reach the boot heel and boot toe, where are they going to go next? I mean, what do you think is going to happen? Yeah.
There are a lot of mysteries about these wars. And I think, you know, we're coming to them as students, and we're not pretending to be people who've spent our lives on this. But I think there are a lot of questions that are raised here. One of them is, did these peoples understand each other at all? Was Rome really something new? Why didn't the Carthaginians understand Rome? Why didn't the Romans give up? Why was this naval power completely unable to show any naval supremacy? And why was a power, Rome, that somebody, as Philip Matuszak quotes, Rome took to naval warfare like a brick to water. How were they able to defeat the dominant naval power of the Western Mediterranean for hundreds of years?
Hundreds of years, yeah.
It does not make sense. And we're just looking at these questions. We're opening them up. I asked one of those questions today, like about what happened to the Carthaginian Navy, on the Gary Brecher Facebook page. And we've had a lot of interesting answers. And maybe we can open up the discussion as we go. Like, I don't think we claim to have the answer here, but what we do have is a received narrative. Like, there's a received narrative of what happened. Rome discovers an intact Carthaginian naval vessel, and the parts are numbered so they can figure out how to create a new one. Okay, maybe. And then they revive the corvus, a kind of movable landing ramp that can extend a gangplank for marines to the other ship, which was used by the Sicilians in past wars. And that enables them instantly to defeat the Carthaginian navy in a massive battle, as big as anything up to the battle of the naval battles of World War II, Ichnomus off the coast of Sicily. I'm getting a little ahead of the story here, but how is that possible? I mean, it makes sense in the traditional classical narrative, but I don't trust classicists. They have these narratives that they got from their sacred texts, and they tend to believe them. Like, okay, somebody invents a gimmick against the Royal Navy in 1850 or something. We're supposed to believe that that alone would work for them? And
I mean, I'm thinking about our Totally Tanked episode. You know, was it Schwarzkopf said, it wasn't the tank, it was the tank crews, right? So that if the well-trained U.S. tank crews were in T-72s, they would have defeated the more poorly trained Iraqi tank crews and Abrams. So it is hard to understand. The Romans were not known to be, they didn't have a history of being great seafaring people, a great Navy. Mm-hmm. Their first two attempts at the Navy, they just sank them. I mean, they were built with green wood. They were terrible at it. And then suddenly a year later, they pop up and they wipe out the dominant naval power for hundreds of years. It is weird. It is really weird. And another question I saw brought up in one book, but they never explored it. They just kind of brought it up like, God, this is strange, was why did the Carthaginians, I mean, this is the First Punic War, mostly in Sicily. It's a very long war. And there are several different sort of invasion waves of Romans moving into Sicily from the Italian mainland. And the Carthaginians never used their navy to try to interdict the Roman landing parties. Why?
One of the things that Flaubert intuited in Salammbô is treason.
I mean,
Carthaginian elite was deeply divided, and they hated each other.
Yep.
And at every key moment in this war, they will betray the Barcas. The Barcas are the war party and the dominant clan. And I think a lot of people in Carthage probably were glad to see them get isolated in difficult places.
The Barcas as an enemy was much closer and more real than this imagined idea that some podunk town, Rome, could actually conquer us. I mean, you have to remember, Carthage was such a far more luxurious, complex, amazing city than Rome was, for example. I mean, it was very opulent, very, like, the building, it was just so much more advanced and so much more sort of dazzling than Rome. Their hatred of the Barco family would have just been much more real to them than the idea they could ever be conquered.
As I was saying, this is a weird moment because, like, I guess we've sort of drifted into an anti-war camp most of the time on Radio Warner, but the war party in Carthage was sort of right. the peace party was sort of wrong. Sometimes you got to stamp them out. Anyway, I think we're going to have to spend more than one episode on this, but we can at least get to the First Punic War, which in some ways is the most important here. Mm-hmm. It's the first face-off between Carthage and Rome. So this is happening around 310 BC. And again, Sicily is the flashpoint. Because as you were saying, Mark, Sicily is very, very rich. It's like paradise, really. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because I was studying Italian this summer with a teacher. You know how when you're studying a language, you slowly discover the real ideology of the teacher because just because of the sentences they choose.
Right, like, yes.
And she was, what I later found out is a real ideology in contemporary Italy called Neo-Bourbonism. And it's this belief that the south of Italy is the naturally rich and good part of Italy, and the north is the grim quasi-Germanic part, and that they robbed everything from Italy. And Garibaldi is not a name to conjure with in the mind of this neo-Bourbon woman who was teaching class. She was really weird too, because like a lot of ideologues want to be hurt, want to be confirmed in their in their rage. So the first question she asked was supposedly for us to practice our Italian is, what are some of the stereotypes for Southern Italians? And everybody looks at each other like,
God,
does she really want us to do this?
Wow. She just wants to lecture somebody so badly.
Yeah. Yeah. So we all gave her those stereotypes, and her foot started tapping faster and faster. And then came the reckoning. And it was like a 20-minute lecture on how that was because they robbed us, they took everything, Sicily is naturally the richest and finest and happiest place in the world. By that point, everybody in the class, you know, they're these mild, middle-aged Austrian people mostly, and they're saying, yeah, sure, okay, absolutely.
No one's arguing.
By the way, Neo-Bourbon is this ideology in southern Italy. It reflects the rule of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, meaning basically southern Italy and Sicily itself, by a Spanish branch of the Bourbon family, so that they dominated the south. And this is creating nostalgia among some southern Italians. I should point out that the counter argument is they treated you like slaves, and that's what you hear in the north. The poverty of 19th century southern Italy is unbelievable. I mean, I think I've said before, you have no sense, especially if you're from North America, how stable your own culture has been, no matter how much it seemed to you it was changing. You got people driving around in zippy little expensive cars now whose grandparents were agricultural slaves all over. I mean, it's extraordinary. Okay, so Sicily is a big prize, and it becomes the scene of the beginning of the first showdown, where basically Carthage and Rome decide, I guess the Mediterranean isn't big enough for both of us anymore. And this is a proxy war, classic proxy war that big powers get into using the little ones, and really sleazy, you know, like the Mamertines, meaning sons of Mars, this group of Italian mercenaries who had been involved in Sicilian warfare. It's too complicated to get into, but basically they just march into what is now Messina on the east coast of Sicily, kill all the men, rape all the women, and say, this is our town now. And they're afraid someone's going to displace them. So they say, hey, Carthage, you want to help us? And Carthage helps. And then they say, hey, Rome, you want to help us? Mm-hmm. You might be stronger than Carthage. And then the Romans come in, and they eventually take Messina, and they ally more effectively with the Romans than they did with the Sicilians. And this gives Rome a toehold. According to the sources we have, which are coincidentally all Roman, this was a big shock to the Romans. Like, it reminds me, using your analogy before, reminds me very much of Pauly and Goodfellas. What do I want with a restaurant? I don't know nothing about the restaurant business.
Yeah.
But they were quite happy to be stuck with it. Like, okay, I'll do you a favor. And that terrifies the Carthaginians. Sicily is one of their biggest possessions. And soon the soon the Romans and Carthaginians are fighting desperately over Sicily. This war is so bloody, like all these wars were, that population size starts to come into it. Rome has become a really big place. Maybe 800,000 people, Carthage with maybe 250,000. But those numbers don't really cover it, because war is the business of a Roman citizen. It's what you're about. War is not the business of a Carthaginian citizen. In fact, it's a little, unless you're a Barca, it's a little rough and crude. It's not for you. You're supposed to hire people to do your wars and stick to trade. You can go into the Navy, and this is sort of common in many cultures. Like, the navies are aristocratic, but armies are very bloody, very rough. So we have to talk about the structure of these two societies.
Yes.
Basically, you know, Romans are crazy. They're killers. we grow up with this idea of Rome as having like inherited the world, and then they started eating grapes and
and backstabbing harps. Each other, and doing Game of Thrones stuff. It's not quite like that. Yeah,
no, they earned it with blood, and they were very enthusiastic about it. Service in the Roman army, and there was no navy at this point. They hated navies. They couldn't swim, basically. It was kind of an honor. You aspired to that. You had to own a certain amount of property to serve in the army. You had to be a Roman citizen, and that was quite a big deal. You know, even St. Paul, centuries later, says somewhere, I think, Romanus sum, like, I'm a Roman, meaning I'm a Roman citizen. You can't torture me without, you know, halfway decent evidence. Right. So serving in the army was the proof that you were somebody. It was an absolute prerequisite to a political career, to membership in the elite. They had a weird system that is sort of reflected in the Carthaginian system, the consulship. They were nervous about military dictatorship, quite rightly. And so they elected two consuls, two because you wanted a two-headed beast. It wasn't efficient. So no one military commander could just say, I run this place now. The consuls had veto power over the other consul's decision, which seems like a recipe for inefficiency. But again, that was the idea. They were members of the aristocratic elite. They were elected yearly by an assembly, which was also made up of that elite. The richer and more snooty citizens were the cavalry. And by the way, Rome had a really lousy cavalry in the beginning. And they did that because in a sort of proto-feudal arrangement, they could furnish their own horse and their own equipment. The middle class, something like the middle class, formed the infantry. And it was an honor to be admitted to the infantry. Mm. The proletari, which means what you'd think, the lower social class.
Sort of the propertyless class, right?
Yeah. Did not get to be infantry. I mean, you wouldn't think this. Get to be infantry? Have a spear stuck in your eye? I mean, but they were lively folks in them days. They thought that way. They did not get to be infantry. They could only serve as oarsmen in the fleet, which they did, and that was part of why Rome was running out of proletarians by the end of this war.
but also the reason why the middle and upper classes would want to exclude them was because war was business for Rome, for especially Rome. I mean, I think for most cultures until recently, you know, war meant booty. War meant you could enrich yourself or move up socially and economically. And
well,
so
it definitely means that now. Remember that stat about the leading zip codes in the U.S.? They're all in Northern Virginia.
But I mean serving. Right. Now it's the opposite. Now when you serve, actually, you end up, you know, on the streets at a VA hospital or a homeless. But if you're feeding into the war machine, you're in a McMansion right now, toasting the next war. So,
Yeah, but that's true. You absolutely wanted control of the war machine because I think it must be related. This isn't usually part of the classical narrative, but look, Romans couldn't sail ships. They were an inland city.
Mm-hmm, right.
They didn't seem to do much with international trade, at least willingly, with willing partners. Carthage was a coastal city, totally at home on the water. They traded with anybody. They had a very different attitude towards war. Carthage could make money in peacetime. It's not clear that Rome could make money in peacetime.
Right.
So the Carthaginian army was a mercenary army, basically, if you want to use that term. But, you know, before we get into this, there's some stat that I think Polybius, one of the better historians of these wars, points out, which is you can talk about mercenaries if you want, but Hannibal spent 16 years in Italy with an army composed of these mercenaries from all kinds of different nations. They went through hell for him. They never defected. They never betrayed him. They fought like demons for him, and they never lost a battle. That's the amazing thing. Hannibal never lost a battle in 16 years in Italy. Incredible.
Whereas the Carthaginian elites were back in Carthage, by, you know, plotting, backstabbing, whatever, right? So that's a really good point, because we always assume, and I think there's often a lot of truth to it, that, I mean, sort of like France's Republican army, right? These were sort of empowered. They had a stake in their society that they were going out to defend and spread. And that supposedly made them better fighters, and might have actually. But this disproves that adage. I mean,
the ancient world was just different. Yeah. There were all kinds of appeals to pride and to your cohort, your general. And that was part of it too. You were loyal to Hannibal or to the Barcos, not to Carthage. It was kind of hard to be loyal to Carthage for a lot of these people because it had a sleazy side, but that was not the Barcos side.
Right.
So these are so-called mercenary units from some of the African neighbors of the Carthaginians, Libyans, who formed mostly infantry, the Numidians, really important, like the best light cavalry in the world. They didn't even use saddles. They had a shield and two or three spears. They would throw the spears, gallop out of range, come back. And they were the key to the Carthaginians' most effective strategy, which is kind of like the little bighorn strategy. You act surprised when the Romans show up. You go, Romans, and then you run away. And the Romans chase you, and you can count on Hannibal to have something waiting for them that they did not expect. And a lot of Romans die that way. Also, Iberians. This is basically Spain. The earliest treaties between Rome and Carthage allowed Carthage to develop colonies south of the Ebro River, which is a little south of the Pyrenees. That meant that Hamilcar dies crossing a river. A lot of people in the ancient world die crossing rivers anyway. And Hannibal, they were building, by all accounts, a Barca empire. They were not thrilled with Carthage as it was. A Barca empire centered in Spain. A lot of silver in Spain, a lot of people who like to fight. And it was virgin territory. They've got them, they've got the Gauls. Gauls really hated Romans. One of the Roman generals in this war likes to go into battle supposedly with a Gaul scalp on his helmet, you know, with the long hair that they wore. Gauls didn't like that, surprisingly. And there's also Greek phalanxes. So it's an army with some weaknesses, as in where are the Carthaginians? They're just not there. But a lot of strength, like they could do many different things. The Greeks or the Iberians could present a wall of shields. The Numidians could harass an enemy. They had slingers who could basically...
Right, Balearic.
Yeah. Just think, you know, you guys from Ibiza, maybe you just do coke and trance music now, but way back then, you were great slingers.
I know, that was a cool little addition to it,
They found some of those sling shots, lead shots, I think, saying in Greek, "Take this."
Oh, they write little things on it?
Yes. Sort of,
like the way they write on missiles nowadays, you know?
Yeah, there's a scene, there's a World War I scene in The Simpsons where the young Monty Burns is watching his officer give a movie speech with a grenade, live grenade in his hand. "Take this. This is for Burns. He's not so..." Yeah, but it was the same spirit. The Navy, as we were saying, was permanent. They always had a Navy, which again is like, yeah, that seems right. So why did they do so badly? That was by Carthaginian citizens. It was a respectable place for elite Carthaginians to serve. The army was just mustered up when you thought you were going to need it, which is generally considered a weakness, and it probably was. And the only time Carthaginian citizens would be conscripted into the army was when the city itself was threatened. So, yeah, there's a difference in force structure or the place of war in the whole culture here. And the strengths of Carthage, like Carthage had a way of existing as a peacetime city. It's not clear that Rome did, not with 800,000 people to feed. You basically had to take some slaves.
Yeah, I mean, well, what's happening around the time of the First Punic War anyway, well, and it really gathers pace up through the next couple ones, is that inequality really is spinning out of control in Rome, and it's sort of warping everything. I mean, we might do some more of this, John, but you and I have been reading some books by Mattishak, and of course there's the, what's it called, the Jugurthine War, the Sallust book that I remember reading. You could just, I mean, the corruption, the backstabbing, it gets so out of hand. But underneath all of that is this sort of accelerating accumulation of land, financialization of land by a smaller and smaller elite. And you've got to do something with, you know, this massive city and everybody else who's disempowered. So you conquer more lands and you find ways to eventually, you know, bring in, you need to conquer a lot more lands in order to appease, you know, the people around you in Rome and give them at least some hope at some point that, you know, if they survive all kinds of crap, they'll eventually get there. But at the time of the First Punic War, you know, that we're still early in that process, I think.
There's a sense that war was beneficial for the people who mattered in Rome. Yeah. And it really didn't seem to be beneficial, except maybe for the Barca clan, if they'd managed to start their own empire in Spain, but that project never really came off. The amazing thing is that in this First Punic War, this allegedly great Carthaginian navy is terrible, just terrible. And again, I don't think anybody's explained this right.
Yeah.
We've talked many times about how armies are degraded by counterinsurgency and low-level, thuggish enforcing of trade monopolies rather than fighting equal opponents. And that could be it, because the Carthaginian navy was very much in favor of sinking competitors' ships, especially the unarmed ships. They were fine with that, but they were not in the habit of fighting equal opponents. Even the Greek city-states were not fully equal. Rome somehow, and this is Rome, which people laughed at Rome as a navy. You know, Rome took to the water, took to naval fighting like a brick to water. Somehow, Rome builds a fleet of 120 ships in 2 months and almost instantly defeats a Carthaginian fleet off Sicily. Again, think of the Royal Navy suddenly being destroyed in the mid-19th century by, say, revolutionary France that just comes up with the idea we're going to need a navy and boom, creates one. The biggest battle in this war, on the naval battle, was Ecnomus off the southern coast of Sicily. The Romans are supposedly victorious because they have this mobile gangplank called the Corvus. Basically just a swivel gangplank held vertically in the middle of the ship until you come into contact with the enemy ship. There's a spike right at the end of the gangplank. So when you release this gangplank, it embeds itself in the enemy ship. That allowed the Romans, who had much better marines on their ships, to board the Carthaginian ships and basically kill everybody. And what was the Carthaginian response to this? There wasn't one. This is a battle with almost 150,000 people on each side. The Carthaginian fleet is supposed to be able to ram the Roman fleet, but it doesn't seem to have any projectile weapons, any other strategies for dealing with the Roman fleet. There's a kind of non-adaptedness in the Carthaginian naval strategy, which is very strange. So basically, they find that to ram the Romans, you need to be right up against them. That puts you in range of this swivel gangplank. When you ram the Roman ships, they swarm onto your ships like ants, and you lose. So they can't do anything about this. The only way they ever win is by knowing the weather better than the Romans. And this is one thing you'd think that a power that's been sailing around that part of the Mediterranean would know how to do. So best move the Carthaginians have is to know the weather, go into harbor, and let the Romans die in huge numbers. So in the Battle of Fynthius, in the middle of the war, 249 BC, there's 120 warships roughly on each side. But the Romans are also protecting 800 troop transports. The Carthaginian captains tell the admiral, we know this weather pattern. We better go into harbor. They do. They ride out the storm. The Romans try to attack. They're out at sea in the storm. They lose 17 ships. They lose all the transports, basically, all but two ships out of this massive fleet. And they come back and they win. They win the war.
Yeah, I mean, a sort of a generalist version of this that I've heard to sort of sum it up is the Romans, you know, got the blueprint, as you mentioned, for the quinquiem. I think I'm pronouncing it right. And, you know, the one that they sort of took apart because what is true is the Carthaginians did have like pretty advanced shipbuilding capabilities, and they did shipbuild them almost like in a factory. So it would be something like numbered. But anyway, so the Romans put out one fleet, but they used green wood. So they basically sank, and they built up another fleet. It still had green wood, still killed some people, but then eventually sank. And, you know, they just kind of kept at it. They would hire Greek mercenaries. They started, you know, imitating shipbuilding and ship tactics from Rhodes. But as you said, you know, all this was, what we know about it was all comes from the winning side, from the Roman side. So it is kind of a mystery. Does a power degrade sort of after 300 years? I mean, it's, I don't know.
And there's really only one source, even on the Roman side, which is the Greek Polybius. There were a lot of sources on the Carthaginian side, but they were all very systematically destroyed. I mean, the Romans destroyed the Carthaginian literature the way the Spanish destroyed the Aztec records. They made a point of it. It was not just an unfortunate accident. That was policy. So all this pedantry about the war, and it's a lot of very impressive pedantry, is based on a single text, basically, and that's kind of frightening. And what I keep finding, and I admit this as someone who's coming to this, not as someone who's dedicated his life to it, but is trying to understand it, what I find is that I keep discovering key facts that ruin the whole narrative. For example, I'm trying to research that famous, ultra-famous military harbor in Carthage, which we visited when we were there. And I'm trying to figure out whether they could actually produce so many triremes in a certain period, as is often claimed, at that famous Circular Harbor, which, by the way, is still there and is pretty cool to look at. But then I just come across this fact that the Circular Harbor was not built until after Carthage had already lost the First and Second Wars. Mm. It was basically Carthage had already been gutted when they built that. They had the cylindrical harbor before that, but that had been, that was supposedly going to be dedicated to cargo. They didn't have that circular harbor that everybody shows diagrams of. That it was not there. Like when you try to find out where and how did Hamilcar Gisco died, well, either his troops crucified him after a defeat on the, and they crucified him on the beach at Sardinia, or he was brought home and tried and crucified there. No one knows. And there's a lot that no one knows. And when you look at the implied narrative, as I said, you many times, you keep coming back to this idea, Carthage's navy wasn't that good. And that's why it's kind of reassuring to come across this book, Carthage's Other Wars by Dexter Hoyos, which was published in 2019. Again, that's Carthage's Other Wars, Dexter Hoyos, H-O-Y-O-S, who finally says some of the stuff that we've been coming across, that we've been concluding reluctantly because it violates these received ideas. There's a lot of Bouvard and Pécuchet, you know, about the Punic Wars. And Hoyos just says, Carthage's prowess at sea was in fact far less accomplished than usually assumed, either by ancients or moderns. Although Greeks and Romans did tend to view Carthage retrospectively as the Western Mediterranean's great naval power, when wars came, its fleets seldom had unmatched superiority over their rivals, nor did a sea battle decide any of Carthage's non-Roman wars. And he goes on to really emphasize this. In warfare and strategy, Carthage's enduring strategy was operations by armies on land. Not one military or political leader was a merchant, meaning, you know, a seafarer. And only one or maybe two were seafarers. The ruling elite was landed grandees, like the latifundia owners in Rome. The ruling elite were landed grandees, like the 4th century's Hanno the Great with his country estate and supposed 20,000 slaves, or Hannibal the Barkid, who owned a wealthy country estate. And driving the point home, he adds, and I got to say, this is a great relief to read this by somebody who actually has the creds. Supreme command in major campaigns was held by the general of the army, the Rab Mahanet. By the way, that's an interesting name. Rab as in, well, it's a Semitic language. So I presume Rab is the same as like rabbi or the
high
official, and the admiral was always his deputy. I mean, you would not have found that with the Royal Navy, for example. They didn't take orders from the army. They ran the thing. So he concludes his book with greater emphasis on warfare at sea. Carthage might have enjoyed greater success in its other wars. It might even have faced the Romans as ruler of all Sicily. That would have changed history. Because you've got something roughly like a Napoleonic Wars confrontation going on in the Punic Wars between an unstoppable land power and what's supposedly a really powerful navy, only it doesn't act like a really powerful navy.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense because towards the end of that war, I mean, again, according to what I have been reading, trying to get some understanding of this, sort of in the last 5+ years of the war, after Rome's invasion into North Africa, into Libya, basically they tried to invade Carthage with this massive D-Day style invasion, and ultimately it was a total failure. And after that, the Carthaginians decided really to wage a war to fully subdue and extract and, you know, fully subdue and extract from Libya and other parts of North Africa. And it was a very lucrative, that was actually quite a lucrative war, and it went very well. They just went in and were able to destroy, pacify, enslave. I mean, they just, it was like something out of, you know, World of Wars or something, what they did there. Whereas in Sicily, where they really needed their navy, you know, it was just an endless expense, and the Romans were too difficult. And I mean, that's sort of one of the you know, aside from treachery, one of the sort of more practical excuses for why the Carthaginians decided after the last time in 241, after the last time their fleet was destroyed, they decided it ain't worth it to build up another fleet and continue this war. It's because, well, their land war was going so well in Libya. And
And that's that was going to yield them new estates.
Yeah.
I mean, that was going to be turned into these giant farms on, not on the Roman model, but very similar to what was going on in Rome.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't want to, you know, my tax money going to stuff that's not going to yield any profit, because the war against Rome was not going to be profitable. You didn't make money fighting Rome. You hung on if you could. But if you were fighting these small local tribes or peoples, kingdoms, whatever, in Numidia or Libya, you could do the usual thing of playing them off against each other and then crushing them one by one. And at the end of it, you'd have this beautiful estate that now no longer had any people in it. So there was a big
faction.
Or you made them slaves, so what Hoyos says, and it's a great relief overall, is like, you know, you can get rid of the myth of Carthaginian supremacy in naval war. He says another thing when you mentioned D-Day, which is like I was thinking, why doesn't Hannibal use Carthaginian ships just to sail his forces to Italy? And I've checked, they did have enough of a fleet that they could have done that by stealth, even in the Second War. But Hoyos says, combined operations with Carthaginian, naval and land forces acting together against an objective are not often heard of. Every one of them failed, sometimes miserably.
Yes.
So they just didn't do that. They weren't good at it. And, you know, there's a strange inflexibility about Carthage, too, maybe because their navy was used to sink pirates and other, you know, rivals for trade. And that sort of low-level service degrades a force. But the lack of projectile weapons in that Battle of Ichnomus that we were talking about seems really extraordinary. Even when they discover the corvus, they must have discovered the corvus fairly early on in the battle because it sticks way up in the air and you can see what it's doing. Well, why didn't they attack the Roman ships from the rear? The corvus does not extend and cannot be extended the entire length of the ship. And they were supposed to know how to attack ships from the rear. They're supposed to be these superb sailors and all that. And it seems to me like a really good example of received ideas that were partly born out of classical education, because the Romans were awfully fond of themselves.
Yes.
And when you think of this being taught to British schoolboys of the empire, it's like they really would have took to that, because it's like one empire that was very fond of itself reading passages from another empire that was very fond of itself. And to do that, they talked about how glorious it was that in a couple of years they managed to field a navy out of nothing and beat this superb, trim, fast, efficient Carthaginian navy. And, you know, there's not much evidence for that.
I mean, there's another angle on this too. Yeah, Polybius, I believe, was writing for, sponsored by one of the consuls. Wasn't it Scipio Africanus? Or and so
I don't know, but yeah,
I remember hearing this in one lecture I was listening to, and I mean, obviously, this was for them, you know, the Great War. They're not going to make your patron and all the elders look a lot better if they defeated the greatest military in history as underdogs. I mean, you can see that in America. You know, we're always, every war, we depict ourselves as underdogs. And you know,
this is, used to get to me, as I think we've talked about a few other times, like when Clint Eastwood tries to make a conquest movie out of the invasion of Grenada. I mean, that was sort of where I defected from America. It's just, no, I refuse. No.
Well, Maurice Bishop, do you feel lucky? You know,
You stage a glorious victory against 500 construction workers from Cuba with AKs.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it's hard to say. I mean, I think there is corroborating evidence that Hannibal, who will be Hamilcar's son for the Second Punic War, you know, is an unusually good, amazing general. But he didn't win.
No.
And the Romans have every reason to sort of.
And they let him down when he needed resupply. They were always letting people down, and that's what we're going to get into in the next episode, where we talk about the literature, well, a particular literary version of the Second Punic War, Salammbô, which is one of the great novels.
It's about the mercenary war.
Yeah, but I'd say it's about the Second Punic War as well, because he's describing the fractures in Carthaginian society.
That's true.
Destroyed it. I mean, Hanno is such a great character in there, and he's considered responsible for one of their defeats at So I mean, I also realized when I was rereading Salammbô that, and I'm sure many an article has been written on this. I haven't read them, but I'm sure they are out there. That Flaubert is not anti-French writer, and he sees France as very Carthaginian and. It's not clear who the Romans are. They can be the British or they can be the Prussians. Probably more likely the Prussians in this story. But it's this gloomy, typically self-loathing French story of how this glittering, beautiful, wealthy culture finally
decadent,
wastes everything. Debacle.
Yeah, debacle. Yeah. Very decadent. That's true. Yeah. I mean, it's almost over the top in that way. So we'll talk about Salammbô more. I had forgotten until I reread it again for this, like, sort of cold, passionate love story it is too. I mean, there really is a love story, but it's so coldly told.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. You haven't really come across any novel like it ever before.
No. I think in a culture like Saudi, maybe it could be understood better. I mean, they're never going to get to meet. She thinks about Matho a lot. He thinks about her all the time. Because in traditional gendered cultures, the male is supposed to be besotted and the woman is supposed, if she is besotted, she's not supposed to let anyone know. So, And then, I don't know if we can do spoilers, but then...
No, Well, we can do it maybe next episode, but let's really save it for next episode. So this has been our big background to what's going to be the next episode, which will be Salammbô, Flaubert Salammbô and the Mercenary War that he writes about, which is really describing the setup for the Second Punic War as well, as you said. I mean, I think Hannibal's even born, or he's certainly mentioned in Salammbô
as the
son. Right,
hidden from everybody because, of course, his fellow Carthaginian elite would kill him if they could.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right, I think we can wrap up part one right now. Thanks again, everyone. Thank you, John.
Thanks, everybody.
Talk to you soon.